Hey, all, if you'd like to support this show because you like it and you love us and we're so cute and adorable, or because you're somehow sadistic and this is an evil plot of yours to support us and then, like, backstab us later, whichever, you can easily do that by going to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanny, sign up for a 1 month free trial membership, you get a free audiobook out of the deal, and you help the show, which means at some point we get to actually buy, you know, like, new clothes and food. So, thanks for listening, hope you enjoy the episode.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, yes. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 115.
Steampunks and griffins and ninjas, oh my!
I'm Sean.
And I'm Jen.
And today's guest is Jay Kristoff. Welcome to our ridiculous show.
Thanks very much for having me.
So you've written a book, or at least I'm assuming it's a book. I guess we could argue about whether or not it's appropriately a book, but that would seem like a pointless argument to me.
I think it's a book.
Okay. How would you define a book? Does it just have to have cover and like pages with writing on it in the middle?
Yeah, something that's sitting on my shelf, I guess.
Okay.
And it is sitting on my shelf, so it does seem to be a book.
Okay.
I usually get paid for.
Ideally, yeah, that'd be wonderful.
So if you don't get paid for it, it doesn't count as a book?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, that's great. We can have a discussion one day about what an actual book is, and we could get in big trouble by saying people who don't get paid for their work don't have books. Thanks, Jen.
You might offend some people if you do that, yeah.
Right. I suppose we should try not to do that too often.
Yeah, no, I would not. But okay, so anyway, so you've written a book called Storm Dancer, which I suppose if you were going to pigeonhole it as a type of book, it would be a Japanese inspired steampunk coal punk dystopia.
I see.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah,
with a bit of epic fantasy thrown in, I guess.
Yeah, it's a mishmash, and in terms of all of the kinds of genres, which may make it difficult to, if like you went to one of those bookstores where they have like every section imaginable, I suspect it would make their heads spin, like, where do we put it? Just put one in every section. Which would be good for you. Yeah. So I guess the big question I want to start with, since you've never been on a show, is what drew you to writing and why fantasy instead of, I don't know, like Nicholas Sparks romance novels?
I've always written in my spare time, I guess, ever since I was pretty young. But I worked as a writer in a professional capacity. I used to work in an advertising agency.
Ooh.
I wrote TV scripts for a living. So the last thing you want to do when you get home from work every day writing TV scripts is write your book. You know, the last thing you want to see is a laptop. So I had the thought of being a writer for a really long time, but I worked in advertising for about 10 years. And after I made the switch and reading between the lines, I got retrenched. I decided that I didn't want to do advertising for a living anymore, and so I moved into a different career path, and that freed me up a little bit to pursue the writing in my free time. And 5 years later, this is kind of where we're at. I wrote fantasy because I've always read it. I'm a huge tragic nerd, and I think tragic nerds write fantasy as a default setting. Yeah, definitely. I tried to write romance, but I'm really not very good at it.
Oh, gosh. Cat.
Wife, agree.
Sorry, that noise would have been my cat being a dumbass.
That's all right. My dog's in bed, so if he knew there was a cat on the other line, he'd be really upset right now.
So, okay, so you always kind of written, and I'm really curious now, since you said you worked in advertising, which to me sounds like a grueling job, but it... In what way do you think that
nothing
might have...
Like
say what?
It's nothing like Mad Men. Don't believe HBO.
But that would make it so much more interesting, I think.
It would be really interesting. But as far as I'm aware, no one murdered anyone at the agencies that I was working at. No one had any intermarital affairs that I was aware of, at any rate. No one looked like Don Draper, so we were all very dull.
But copious amounts of liquor still, right?
No, there's none of that. It's really dull. Maybe in the 80s, you know, when people had yachts and did cocaine parties and whatever, I must have just missed out on all the fun stuff and got stuck with the boring workaday advertising life.
But would you say, how do you think your career in advertising influenced how you write now, or did it?
Probably, yeah. I guess when you've got 30 seconds to work with, as most TV ads tend to be, you learn how to get to the point quickly. I'm not sure I did get to the point quickly in my book, but you learn how to show rather than tell, I guess, because you can't really be inside the head of a character in a television commercial. You don't really get to explain their motivations and what they're thinking. You really have to illustrate by doing. So I think that probably came across a little bit. And also thinking visually. I mean, television is a very visual medium, and I tend to write quite visually. A lot of people say that. It has bled through a little bit, yeah.
My very first impression of this, which is, sorry, Sean, I'm going off script here. My very first impression of, you know, the first chapter, it felt like, can you really call it a chapter? It's like two pages, but it felt like Hong Kong action film, but the more artistic ones like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and House of Daggers or whatever, where you had this incredibly rich, detailed, you know, you even mentioned the blossoms falling. It was a very detailed sort of scene. How much influence do you think you drew from that type of film?
Like the waifu kind of film, you mean?
Yeah.
Hero and House of Flying Daggers. Yeah, a little bit, I guess. I do enjoy those films. I own a couple of them on DVD, but visually, I think I probably borrowed a little of that aesthetic, yeah. In terms of the storytelling structure or mythology or anything like that, probably not a lot, but aesthetics, yeah, sure, certainly.
And that actually draws, because this is related to one of my questions, actually, is this, and while reading this, and I'm not going to pretend like I'm a Japan expert by any stretch of the imagination, but I know a little bit about Japan, and I kept seeing things and going, that's analogous to something that happened in real history. That's something that might have actually happened. This is related, you know, that in some sense your use of this setting, this Japanese setting, is rather, I would say, it seems rather thorough. And I'm really curious for you what it implies to me that you didn't just have like a passing fancy and you decided, I'm going to write a book with Japan people in it. And that was how you went about it. No, it seems like you have like a interest in Japanese culture or some sort of deeper connection. And is that true, or am I just kind of projecting?
No, I think it's true. I mean, it's not alt history. It's not set in Japan. The setting's really just inspired by it. And I've taken pieces from Japanese culture. I've taken pieces from Chinese culture. I've made pieces up entirely. So I don't ever tell people that it's indicative of real world Japan. I've kind of borrowed from the aesthetic and I've borrowed from the mythology. And that's something that I've been interested in since I was very young. But yeah, I'm always careful to tell people that it's not any comment on real world Japan. It's not supposed to be an alternate history. It's an entirely fantastical setting, and the rules are a little bit different in terms of, you know, religion and language and even aesthetic in certain parts. So, but yeah, I've had a fascination for Japan since forever, really, since I was a little kid. So that certainly helped in writing the book. Yeah, sure.
And So, I mean, yeah, and I think when thinking about it, I mean, there are a lot of influences there, and it's perhaps really important for people. We haven't even talked about the book in any specific terms, but it's not set in the real world. It's set in a secondary world. I mean, it's pretty obvious because it's got a cute little map, and I like the map. But I kept thinking, like, I kept looking at the map going, was this accidentally? Because the references are just, whether they were intentional or not, I just kept thinking, like, I'm watching, like, a really... Like a Hayao Miyazaki film, but if he did a samurai film. And it just kept, I don't know, like Steam Boy meets Samurai X is what I kept thinking.
Yeah, right.
So, but it's in fact, yeah, I mean, as you say, it is a secondary fantasy world. I don't know where I'm going with that. Save me from myself, Jen.
Well, I thought you were leading into your next question, which was, you know, it you pay a lot of attention to the social dynamics of the clan-based culture, which is obviously Japanese-rooted, but although that we have clan-based cultures all over the world, Yukiko and Kasumi both point out the conflicts between the different clans. Obviously, you have Dragon is the leading clan at this point in time, but the main characters are Fox. So we were going to ask, you know, how did you decide to structure it in clans, and how did you decide on, you know, which clans had precedence and whatnot?
I don't know. That's actually a really good question. I guess I like writing underdogs, and you know, the Fox Clan are probably the bottom of the pile in the world that I built. They're a little bit rural. They're a little bit backward, I guess. They're viewed as yeah, the bottom of the rung by the other clans. That, I mean, there is another tier below them in the caste structure, which I kind of explore a little bit in the second book, which are people that have no clan at all. Right. And they're based on a group of people in Japan who are called Barakamon, and they're people that have ancestors that did traditionally unclean jobs, kind of working with meat or working with corpses. And yeah. It's Barakamon is actually, it's a really bad word in Japanese society. If you call someone that, you're insulting them quite deeply. It's almost akin to the N-word. So I explore that a little bit in the second book. But yeah, in terms of structuring the clans as it is, yeah, I guess I like writing underdogs. I like writing people that aren't at the top of the pile. And it's a little more fun that way, I think, when you're looking up at the bad guys and they have everything and you have very little. Yeah, but I don't have a great answer to that question. I've never been asked that before, so you start thinking. Maybe it'd be stupid.
That's okay. So are we. We just pretend to be smart sometimes. I did think it was interesting. I mean, the dynamics of the clan culture play, I think, more of a role once you meet the people that are clanless. But they've many of them have specifically separated themselves from the clans. They've burned off their clan signs, for instance. Can you talk a little bit about the conflict between that for those people, I guess?
Yeah, they're a rebellion called the Kage, which it means shadows in Japanese. And they're people who were members of the four clans and have decided to make a deliberate break from it all. So they're a little different from the people who were born with no clan. These are people who were part of society and realized that society isn't as great and awesome and fun as it should be and have decided to instigate a change. So as a symbol of that severance from what is, they've kind of burned off their tattoos. That's their initiation rite, I guess, in joining that rebellion, decided to cast off everything that society offers them and start something new. And yeah, they're kind of the rebellion from Star Wars. You know, they're fighting the evil empire and trying to make things great and awesome for everyone rather than the elite few.
They seem to recognize that the clan system within the Shima Imperium is broken, which is not necessarily the fault of the clans themselves. It seems more that it's the fault of the Lotus Guild, which is kind of this overarching control. And I kept flashing to the Spice Guilds and Dune, but that seemed to be more where the break in society has occurred, the power level that the Lotus Guild holds over the clan system.
Yeah, it's a, I guess it's an uneasy alliance between the Lotus Guild, who supply the military hardware and supply the fuel, but the clans supply the men, I guess, the people. The guild itself isn't that big. They just have an inordinate amount of power because of the control over technology they wield. But if, you know, if the entire country were to rise up in rebellion against them, they couldn't deal with it. They still need the cooperation of the government. They still need the actual meat that the clan armies will put up to fight the wars overseas, because the nature of the lotus plant, it destroys the ground that it grows in after a little while. So the country needs to be constantly expanding the lands that it controls. It's kind of, it's ruined the islands that, you know, it's ruined the Shima Imperium, and they're currently in a war of conquest with people overseas to try and get more arable land to plant this flower and continue the cycle. So the guild are in this kind of uneasy alliance, this wedding, I think I describe it as, between two people who hate each other, but they need each other. They can't really live without one another. So I like that power dynamic, that you know that either side would probably shiv the other in the back if they were given the opportunity, but at the present time, they kind of have to hold hands in public and pretend they like each other.
It's like, I'm just imagining this, and now that you made it in terms of a wedding, I'm just imagining, like, you know, two people that got drunk one night and, like, one of them got pregnant and they realize, oh my gosh, I can't believe I did that. But we have to have this baby, and the families force them to get together.
Surviving my marriage, I'm just saying.
You like your husband. There's a difference. Hold on. They hate each other, right? But they get married, but they despise each other's guts, but they just have to for the child's sake. And so the child is like the country. I'm just imagining this in terms of these, like, metaphors of, like, really broken up, messed up families that talk with funny accents and yell at each other all the time.
But I think with the book, I mean, it's definitely, it's a obviously it's a broken marriage, but it's more of a broken cycle. Yes, the Lotus Guild depends on the clans. The clans depend on the Lotus Guild, but it's sort of this vicious, you know, like, why do we depend on each other? You know, we only depend on the clans, essentially only depend on the Lotus Guild because of what the Lotus Guild has produced, which is this whole Lotus-based economy. And I'm really glad you said meat at one point when describing what they need from the clans, because not only do they need the bodies of the clansmen themselves, but they need the slaves that the clans are bringing back. So it's not just that they need land to work. They also require this sort of constant influx of slaves for a number of reasons, some of which are not particularly pleasant.
No, we probably can't talk too much about that because that's like a spoiler. But
it's a huge spoiler.
Good one, Jen.
Well, she didn't actually spoil it. She walked to the edge and then turned away. So,
On this subject, then maybe something we can talk about that's not, I don't think, necessarily spoils. The fact that, you know, that you talk about the Lotus Guild, and I have lots of other questions about the Lotus Men, but they live in this world in which they're burning Lotus, and I'm going to assume that's, it's not quite exactly like coal, but it's similar to coal in that there's still this offshoot of gunk that is going into the atmosphere. And for a lot of the people who are poor or don't have a lot of money, such as Yukiko, who is not particularly rich, they basically have to breathe this garbage, whereas the Lotus Men run around in these amazing technological, like, giant metallic toads or something. And so one of the interesting things in it, about this book is that it's looking at, I think, a lot of the sort of environmental impacts of this kind of a sort of, like, rabidly burning, expanding culture, that in fact, this is really great that you want to expand and you want to get all this new territory and arable land. Meanwhile, all of your people are dying of black lung disease or getting black lung disease, et cetera, and they're just toiling in filth. And this is like, this is a system that you could just tell, like, this is not going to last, guys. At some point, this is going to collapse just by the sheer fact that eventually you're going to run out of people who can actually do the work. But could you talk a bit about, like, I mean, why, what for you was compelling about talking about the kind of environmental elements?
I mean, whenever I talk about that aspect of the book, I have to be really careful. I don't want to come across as an author on a soapbox or an author with an agenda. I mean, the book should kind of stand by itself as just an adventure story and a maybe a coming of age story and a cool fantasy. And if people want to read something beyond that in terms of a statement about the world that we live in and our dependence upon technology and the way the elite in this world kind of go about their daily business and ignore the suffering and hardships of kind of lower class, working class people, then that's all cool. But I don't feel as an author it's my place to kind of point that out or appear like it was the intent of the book, you know. I mean, there probably is a deeper message in there. There probably is an analogy you could draw about the world that we live in and Shima. But, you know, I don't want to put a big flashing neon sign over its head and you know, say, look, aren't I clever, holding up this dirty mirror to society and saying all this deep shit about the world we live through, you know, just, this family story that I'm telling. So that's not the intent of the book. Like,
you're an environmentalist and a class warfare occupier. Just admit it, because I think we all know.
Yeah, I am a closet anarchist. if people want to draw that and get that message from the book and read something deeper into it, that's awesome. But yeah, I don't feel it's really my place to kind of point fingers at it or make a statement about it. I think you can come off as a little bit of a jerk doing that as an author. So if people want to read something more into it, that's great.
Okay, then. So
wait, hold on. Kim Stanley Robinson got it put in the jerk category. I'm teasing, no, because Kim Stanley Robinson is a very vocal like environmentalist, and you don't even need to know that about him personally. I mean, you just
Tobias Bacall. I'm just saying.
Well, Tobias Bacall, yeah, too, yeah.
That I mean, that's totally awesome. I totally respect people who make that stand. I mean, my experience is people tend to, if you put any kind of ism or ist at the end of your name, you know, you're an environmentalist or you're a socialist or you're a capitalist or whatever, then people can very quickly decide they don't want to hear what you have to say, because I'm not a capitalist, I'm not a communist, I'm not what you are. And so it's very easy to pigeonhole people and discount their opinions when you can easily classify what they are and who they are. So I'd rather have a discussion than make a lecture, if you know what I mean.
Definitely. Okay, so you mentioned one of the things that you did kind of intend was the coming of age story for Yukiko. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think she starts the story as, I mean, she kind of knows who she is. She's had to grow up pretty quickly because her dad's a bit of a deadbeat and her mother isn't around anymore, and she's quite alone in the world, I guess. So she's almost an adult when the story starts. She's almost the parent figure. She takes care of her father because he's kind of lost his way and become a drug addict and a gambler, and he doesn't really have a lot of purpose in his life anymore. So I guess you could call it a coming of age story, but it's more, I guess she just shifts her point of view, or maybe has her point of view clarified. She has suspicions and kind of deep held feelings about the way the world works and the way society is, and that it's probably not as good as it should be. I mean, she gets to view both parts of the equation because her father works for the Shogun. So she gets to see life at the Imperial Court and how these people live, how the elite live. But she's part of the common class. She's not a noble-born person. So she, as a general rule, every day she's out on the street seeing these people living in filth and having to work in these horrible factories and dying of black lung and whatever. So she has this discontent already. And I guess over the course of the book, that is clarified, I guess. It's crystallized, and by the end she knows that things are wrong and she needs to do what she can to fix it.
And so part of that journey is – are we cutting off? Sorry. It's being weird sounding to me. Part of that sort of coming of age, well, or clarifying of position, is connected to the main fantasy element of the story, which is Buru, the thunder tiger, which is essentially a griffin, except a tiger bottom instead of...
Thunder tiger sounds just better than griffin. Let's get that out of the way. Thunder tiger, badass. Griffin, just kind of, whatever.
Whatever, I like griffins too.
Thunder tiger.
But obviously, you know, she makes this connection with this thunder tiger, who kind of goes through his own process of discovery of the world that he's in along with her. But he seems to be kind of the impetus for her to make some final decisions on how she views the world. Why a thunder tiger, A, and B, well done. He's pretty awesome, I have to say.
Thanks. So why a griffin as opposed to a dragon or something like that, do you mean?
Or a flying chipmunk, whichever.
Chipmunk, exactly.
I guess kind of dragons are done a lot. I don't want to say they're overdone. I don't think you can ever overdo dragons, but I think they're probably the go-to guy as far as a mythical creature in, you know, fantasy settings. So I guess I wanted to do something a little bit different. But griffins by themselves are kind of dull, so I wanted to spice him up a little bit. I mean, tigers are just cooler than lions, so I made him half tiger instead of half lion. I guess I tried to build a little bit more into them. You know, griffins are just kind of dull. So I wrapped them up as part of the mythology. I tried to insert them into – I borrowed a little bit off Shinto mythology and religion, and I built the thunder tigers into that religion kind of mystical background. So they're creations of the thunder god, who's called Raijin in Shinto. And their wings make like the sound of the thunder in the skies, which is, it's not true. That's just part of the mythology. But people seem to really like him as a character. He's speaking to readers, people have read it so far. He seems to kind of be the star of the book, which is kind of surprising to me, really. Like he's funny and he's sarcastic and all, but people seem to really resonate with him, which is cool. I kind of based him in part on my dog, really. A lot of early kind of animal behavior is it really comes from just watching my dog and the way he acts around me and my wife. There's one scene where she's talking to a boy and he gets jealous and he's kind of butting up against her and saying, "Don't talk to him, talk to me." And that's something that my dog does every day when my wife pays too much attention to me rather than him. So, yeah, he's a lot of fun to write, and I'm really glad that people seem to like him.
Now, to be clear, your dog doesn't talk, right?
No, he's not that awesome. He's pretty awesome, but he's not that good.
I was going to say, you know, because if your dog can talk, we might want to get on this in terms of, like, you know, breeding programs, and because that would be awesome to have a talking dog.
I go wake him up. He can do the interview for me. He might be funny.
Dogs don't wake up at 8 o'clock in the morning on Saturday either.
I don't think anyone does.
Excuse me. I had a question and now I've forgotten it because I got distracted by the dog.
Dogs are so cute.
You can edit that bit.
Yeah, of course. So one of the other things, that fantasy elements that you've included, and I'm curious if this is also based on Shinto, is the, and you have a fairly elaborate legend regarding the demons that exist in the world. And presumably, hopefully we get more of the demons. Not that there's not enough conflict in the series as it is, but you've also added in, you know, demons from the underworld that are escaping. Just saying.
Yeah, they do play a bigger role kind of later down the track. I won't say anything more because my editors will probably kill me. But yeah, that underworld and the cracks getting bigger, it's a plot element that appears in the second and third books as well. Yeah, but I mean that legend, the Izanami and Izanagi legend, that's something that's straight from Shinto, which is, you know, the maker god and his wife create the world, and she dies in childbirth and goes to the land of the dead. He goes after her to get her back, but she's eaten at the hearth of the dead. It's kind of like it's really strange. There's some parallels between Hades and Persephone, and also yeah. Orpheus and Eurydice, even though, you know, those legends were created literally on opposite sides of the world. There's some really interesting parallels to Greek mythology and Roman mythology as well. But yeah, so she got corrupted by the land of the dead, and he pretty much bailed and left her behind to breed this big army of demons in the underworld that one day want to come back and take over the world. So yeah, some bad stuff might be happening in the next couple of books in that regards, but I can't talk too much about it because the spoiler police will kick my front door in.
Right, and I'm just going to have to spend until the next book comes out conjecturing on how everything is connected. Because like I said, I mean, there is a lot of conflict in here. You've got obviously the conflict between the guild and the clans, the rebels and the guild and the clans, and those with magic and the clans, and, you know.
It's really actually quite elaborate when you think about it, because I'm not going to name any particular books, but sometimes, you know, you'll read a book and it'll be a fantasy book, but you can tell, like, they've spent like 8 minutes putting this world together. You know, it's not really, they just took like Europe, they mixed some French people in, like just threw an Italian in there just to be cute, and that's the world, and took some swords and some dragons and done. But like when you look at your world, it's a rather complicated social system, a rather complicated world. And just in the Jen talking about, you know, the conflicts between the clans, the conflicts between the different classes, the even to some extent like the conflict between the emperor and the people who he is essentially telling to go do all of these things. I mean, the beginning of the book, I'm not ruining anything, but the beginning of the book is the emperor basically says, yeah, so I hear that some people flying around out there saw Griffin, and they're supposed to be extinct, so go send a bunch of people to go find it. And, of course, the bunch of people that get sent out there, it's basically just assumed they're all basically getting kind of screwed over because they assume there's no Griffin, right? This is all a myth, and basically if we don't come back, we're screwed. If we don't come back with a Griffin, we're basically effed. That's the end for us. And so you have that conflict. I appreciate that level of sophistication in terms of the world.
I don't think anyone's ever called me sophisticated before. That's cool. I guess it kind of gets more complicated as the books go on. There's a conflict that's kind of hinted at in book one that really isn't explored at all, that is one of the central premises for book two and book three. But it does, the books do get thicker. I mean, I'm working on book three at the moment, and it's only planned as a trilogy, so I've actually got to wrap everything up. it's probably, at the moment, it's probably twice as thick as the first book. So it might be really cool making things that complicated and sophisticated, but when you've actually got to tie it all in at the end and make it all make sense, you might want to, you might get a little bit upset at yourself for making things difficult.
You don't want to end up with a George R. R. Martin issue where his books have gotten so complex, he's like, I don't even know how to end this anymore. I'm on book like 5, which really means he's on like book 10,000 because his books are 8 million pages long. So yeah, but
I heard a story that he has a guy, a fan, I'm not sure whether this is true or one of these urban legends, but it's actually a cool story. He apparently has a fan who knows more about Westeros than he does, so whenever he has a question about a lineage or a conflict in the past, he actually rings this guy up and says, now, was it true that so-and-so did blah, blah back in X year? And this guy is like his living encyclopedia, which is kind of cool.
Well, I mean, there's Westeros.org, which is like, you know.
Massive, yeah.
It's it's amazing how much people have, well, A, read into the books, and B, just puzzled out these just teeny tiny clues that George R. R. Martin probably has no idea they're even there. And they're like, this is totally a clue for this. And you have to wonder if down the road he'll be forced to, not necessarily forced to, but he might have to, you know, adhere to the mythos that he's accidentally created.
That's the really cool thing, though. I mean, when you get people reading into the book, I've had this experience already just with the first one, having conversations with people about where they think it's going to go. It's actually not a bad thing. Sometimes I can come up with really cool ideas, and you can pinch them, I guess. I used to, when I used to run my D&D game, talking about being a huge nerd, I would talk with my players afterwards about what they thought was going to happen, my wife in particular. And she would say, oh, I think this and that and the other. And she would actually come up with some really cool ideas that I would totally riff on. And she would feel proud of herself because she guessed what was going to happen. And I was happy because she came up with a much better story twist than I could. So,
okay, so just a totally personal question. But did you meet your wife at a D&D game?
No.
I thought it was going to get hope for us nerds, but no.
she is a huge nerd, but no, we met at a club, I think. It wasn't a nerd club either. It was just a regular club. But
how typical. Gosh.
I play D&D. Shush. I have to say that it is particularly impressive how much depth you put into this, considering the fact that it is only a 300-page book. I don't know how many words are in it, but it's...
It's a kind of tightly packed 300 pages, though. There's not room in that leading. The margins aren't very big at all. And the UK edition is something like 450 because they gave the typography a little bit more room to move. So
that's interesting. But I was just going to say that I'm going to have to spend the next year conjecturing on, you know, what are you going to do with the Lotus Guild and kin? I'm really interested in that aspect of things, and I'm sure other people will be like, well, I think other things are more interesting. But the Lotus Guild as a construct, I thought was particularly interesting because they're both a religious and an industrial organization. You know, not only do they you've got the purifiers, for instance, and then the artificers. The artificers are the engineers. The purifiers are essentially the priests. And that whole world of the guilds is based on the Lotus, which acts as both, as we've mentioned, power source and a drug. So they've got people hooked on a number of different levels. But what was the inspiration for the Lotus Guilds, and where are they going? You don't have to stop.
Yeah, you find out a little bit more or a lot more about them in the second book, I guess. There's another group. I mean, there's the three groups that get introduced in the first book. They're essentially the engineers, the soldiers, and the priests. And there's a third or fourth group called the Inquisition. They're kind of like a secret police, well, not so secret, within the guild itself that kind of maintain the dogma, maintain the spirituality of it, that kind of pseudo mysticism that they've wrapped up this flower inside. But yeah, you find out a little bit more about the inner workings and the upper echelons of the guild and what their ultimate agenda is. And there's kind of conflicts within the guild as well. There are people who genuinely believe in that kind of pseudo mysticism that they've surrounded this plant in, and there are others who are purely kind of mercenary and don't ascribe any higher intent or purpose behind it all. So yeah, that's kind of fun, and we kind of get that through Kin's eyes. He becomes a lot more of a major character in the second book, and he's the conflicts in his background and what happens to him in the second book is kind of the window to exploration of the Lotus Guild. But as to where it all came from, I'm not sure. I think, as with a lot of my writing, I kind of made it up as I went along. You know, Kin is the character that we kind of get introduced to a lot of those concepts through. And I don't know, I guess I just tried to put myself in the position of what how a fantasy based society would kind of integrate this technology, and how what is essentially a pretty fantastical kind of notion, this plant that can be a drug and can be a fuel, and at the same time as it grows it kind of destroys the land that it's growing in, that how you could combine that technology and fantastical element into a cult, I guess, the organization that runs it. But that was like a totally rambling answer. I'm not sure that made
no I think it made sense.
I just pulled it out of my ass and made it up as I went along.
Isn't that what writers do?
It made sense at the end.
Yeah. I think it did. And it gives us some sense of, I think, the motivations behind the sort of Lotus Guild. And although I am curious, because you say, you know, you tried to get into like this perspective, and I'm really curious how one gets in the perspective of a people that spends his life inside this contraption, because they're so, the way they're presented in the text is so they're almost like alien, you know, because you think of like Yukiko or Kasumi will describe them, and they call them Lotus Men, and that they're just flying around doing their thing, and but you get no sense that there is some sort of like a human being inside there. They're just these machines inside the this, yeah, it's, I think it's just a very interesting, you know, that they're supposed to be the elite. They're supposed to be these, you know, these really important figures, and, you know, you're not supposed to get in their way because you get in trouble, you could get shoved up in prison, all that kind of thing. And yet they're almost like a steampunk alien creature. At least that's how I took it. And that makes them just more creepy, I think.
Totally. Yeah, but I mean, they're actually people inside those suits, and
which just makes it worse.
Yeah, but the on the outside, they appear to be this big, scary, faceless machine. But inside, it's a person with kind of real feelings and real hopes and aspirations. But they're being brought up in what is essentially a cult. They get raised from the moment they're born to believe a certain way and to think a certain way. And so what happens when your way of thinking, the way you see the world, doesn't fit with this society that you've been brought up inside? And that's where Kin comes in. He's kind of conflicted about who he is and the way the world should work, the way he's been raised versus the way he thinks the world should be. And that's catalyzed through his experiences with Yukiko, because she's, to him, she's kind of everything he could never be. I think that's why he becomes so infatuated with her. She represents this kind of notion of freedom that he's never really experienced before. So,
well, he's not allowed to experience it. I mean, the cult is they're literally within a bubble. I mean, that's essentially what the suits are for. They're not even. I found it absolutely fascinating that their entire the cult depends so much on this the lotus flower, and yet they're not even supposed to breathe or partake in that flower. It somehow poisons them, you know.
Well yeah, because it poisons everyone else.
Poisons everybody else, but I mean they've taken it to another level, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a sacrament to them. I mean, they all smoke it when they're – I'm not really giving anything away when I say this, but they have like a initiation ceremony, I guess, when they're 13 years old, where they breathe it once, and they breathe so much of it that they see visions. It's kind of a pseudo-religious experience for them. But after that point, they're not allowed to breathe it at all. And the reasons for that kind of become apparent as the story progresses, so I can't talk too much about it, but yeah, it was fun to write. It was cool.
That's actually really interesting. I'm not familiar if there's anything similar like that within sort of Japanese or other Asian cultures, but I know in certain cultures in Africa, they'll go through experiences in which they either consume some sort of what we would consider a drug now, but which would have been some sort of herbal remedy that just happens to we manufacture into like cocaine or some craziness. But they would partake in these herbs, and then they would run their bodies to the maximum. I mean, they would do these chants and kinds of things. And until essentially they had visions. And I actually had an anthropology professor who said he didn't believe any of this stuff. He just thought it was all hogwash and, you know, just people running around thinking nonsense. And then he went and had an experience while he was doing anthropology work, and he came back becoming like this new age hippie, totally believing you could have these experiences. And it's kind of the same kind of idea, you know, this at 13, you partake in this the lotus, and it is supposed to give you kind of visions. And that's a rather common thing in a lot of cultures now that I think about it. I mean, even Native Americans have some of that aspect in their cultures.
The peyote cult still exists in the United States.
There you go.
It's not actually a thing, but...
Oh, go on. Yeah.
I was just going to ask, is peyote legal over there? Can you, like, go to a peyote camp and take it?
It is legal for the religious groups that use it, but that is...
Okay.
They are allowed to cultivate a certain amount of it and to use it, but that's it. And it's only
so
in the Southwest.
Could you join the religion for a day and get high on peyote and then say, no, this really isn't for me, and leave?
I don't believe that's allowed, but...
Yeah. I suspect there's a rigorous kind of, like, yeah.
You know, it's primarily the... I'm not sure which tribe it is. It might be Hopi, but... It's very specific to them, and they're the only ones. And there's only a couple of people that are allowed to produce it. It's not like every person within the religion is allowed to cultivate it. It's like one or two people. So
if you want to have hallucinations, Salvia divinorum is totally legal in the United States.
I don't even know what that is. What is that?
I guess the best way to describe it is it's similar to marijuana, only it gives you like a really crazy trip. I have a friend who took it once, and that was the only time she ever took it. So
it's not ringing. It's one of the most ridiculous things. It's
some people enjoy it. Some people have really bad experiences. That's what I've been told. And she just didn't have a very good experience. It was made her slightly paranoid. So,
but
she,
it's. Yeah. Very popular with the youth of the United States. Since
well, so is licking toads. So,
well, yeah, granted, but I don't think licking toads is legal, or it shouldn't be anyway.
How does the toad feel about it?
What I wonder is, how do you monitor that? Like, how do you know?
I don't know. I don't even want to know.
Is there like a toad police? Like, people go around looking for people carrying toads for no reason?
I don't know these things.
I'm just saying. It just seems like the most ridiculous thing to regulate. I don't know how you do it. I don't know. Anyway, I'm sorry. We're talking about stuff that doesn't matter. sorry.
Now is the perfect time for silly questions, though.
Oh, do you want to do the quick five? Oh, can I ask him one more like serious question first?
Ask him one more serious question, but we are hitting our hour.
Okay. All right. Just one serious question, because it's related to another question Jen was curious about is the Shima Imperium is actually at war, as we'd mentioned earlier, and I found it really interesting because I'm a post-colonial scholar, so I read lots of texts that make you depressed at the end. it's mostly what I do. I say that kind of, you know, jokingly. But one of the interesting things I thought throughout this book is the way the characters talk about these people, they talk about as round eyes, which I thought was really interesting as a kind of reversal on what we would typically associate with the kind of, like I said, Orientalist sort of perspective. Orientalism is in Said, so nobody doesn't think I'm calling people of Asian descent Orientals, because that would be wrong. But I'm curious about this sort of colonial relationship to this other country, because Jen thought that it seemed like analogous to United States, but I'm not necessarily convinced it is, but it could be. It doesn't even matter which country it is analogous to. It's just a matter of fact that I think we're all agree that it's white people getting their asses handed to them, which makes me happy for once. But could you, I guess, just kind of talking about that kind of scenario, the war.
Yeah, I guess you could draw parallels between. Whether it's modern day colonialism or colonialism of the 18th and 17th centuries, I mean the Imperium is basically at the point where it needs to either it needs to acquire more land, whether that's through invasion or through cooperation. It's destroyed itself. So if this technology-based system is going to continue to run, they need more soil to plant this blood lotus inside. So it seemed a logical turn of events. If you're the most technologically advanced civilization on the planet, you're probably not going to view the people across the oceans as someone you would cooperate with when you can just take what they have. I mean, that's kind of human nature. It's a conflict that we've seen throughout history, whether it's, you know, the Roman Empire or after. So if you want to draw those parallels again between a kind of a reverse Western imperialism, then that's cool. You can read into that what you like. But again, I'm kind of careful as an author pointing fingers and saying what I was thinking. I think the book should probably stand on its own merits, and you should you know, draw your own conclusions and think for yourself. And if you want to draw those parallels and think about the world that we live in and the way certain governments are acting towards other countries, then yeah, that's all good. That's kind of the point of fiction, I guess, making you look at the world that you live in a different way through a completely fantastical world, I guess. But I mean, as far as the white guys getting their butts kicked, you know, it's probably a cool thing, but it's not so much to me. It's not so much about the races involved. The fact that the guys across the sea getting their butts kicked are white is largely irrelevant to me. It's more they could very easily have been similar to the Shimans in terms of racial characteristics, but it's more that these people across the ocean have something that the Shiman people need, and they're going to take it.
Well, and you have the added benefit of people who look different can be portrayed as inhuman, and therefore,
yeah, and that's the way people of
being treated as slaves and other things.
Yeah, I mean that's the way human beings have acted since forever. I mean, we always look for an other, and if there is no other, then we'll create one within our own society. So,
yeah. That's speaking of Yukiko, although I'm not going to spoil that, even though
no more spoilers. You're spoiling so much about his book, and then people won't read it.
I haven't spoiled a single thing, I don't think. Anyway,
no, you've been good.
I try really hard not to spoil anything.
Okay, all right. So we got to do our silly five questions. So these are just quick answers. So you just whichever – you don't have to explain it. You just answer whichever one you happen to like. So all right, here we go. First question, would you rather fly bareback on a griffin or thunder tiger, or would you ride in a giant metal breathing apparatus / robot?
Probably a griffin, I guess.
Okay. All right,
robots are the bad guys. I don't want to be a bad guy.
Okay, would you serve the Emperor King or go freelance like Davy Crockett?
Freelance. Again, it's that love for the underdog.
Yep, he likes raccoon hats. Do they have raccoons in Australia or some version?
No.
I know that's like sounds like a really dumb question, but raccoons are, you know, they're like squirrels. They can hide on boats.
No, we have something called a possum, which is kind of like a raccoon, but they don't have stripy tails. They just have kind of rat tails, I guess. They're like big rats.
Yeah, we have possums here too. So, okay, that makes sense.
Okay.
I don't think you can make hats out of them.
Out of possums? No, because nobody toes near. Have you ever met a possum? They're evil.
With raccoons.
Yeah, they're pretty vicious.
Like, they're satanic. Like, that sound they make when they're angry is not like a get away from me sound. That's like them chanting to Satan. You just have to learn to translate it, Jen. I spent a lot of time with the Catholic Church fighting against. I'm just kidding. This is not true. Anyway, okay. So number three, if you were abducted by aliens tomorrow and you had to pick one book not originally written in English to take with you, which would you choose?
Oh, man.
How kind of question is that?
How would I read it if it's not written in English?
It could be translated. It translates fine.
Seriously, that is a tough question, Sean.
That's a really tough question.
I know. That's why I ask him. This show's about the hard questions.
Can I bring a friend? Can I take a vow? Buy a vow? I don't know.
Screw the not originally in English. Just go with what book would you take with you?
Like the one book. So this is one, the only book I ever get to read for the rest of my life.
Yes.
Well, that's not stipulated. It doesn't say how long your abduction is for. But let's just assume that for, you know, long enough that you could read one book. They're going to bring you back in a couple of days.
That's just not
as long. So this is essentially, it's kind of a masked, what is your favorite book ever question, really, isn't it?
Kinda.
He's found us out, Sean.
Quick diversion. While my cat tears my headphones up. Get off of me. What are you doing?
Shit. I don't know. I'm going to go with The Hobbit. Let's go with The Hobbit.
Okay, that counts. That's fair.
I need to read it before I go and see the film again. I haven't read it in like 20 years.
That's my kids have stolen it from me, but I keep saying, I'm going to read it again. But my husband keeps insulting me. He's like, The Lord of the Rings is the better book. And I'm like, screw you. I like The Hobbit.
Yeah, I like The Hobbit. Like, that was kind of the first fantasy book I ever read, ever in my entire life. So I know it's kind of cool to hack on Tolkien now, and a lot of people seem to give him a lot of shit nowadays. But, you know, if not for that book, I might never have discovered fantasy as a genre. So I owe Professor Tolkien a lot, I think. So, yeah, let's go with The Hobbit. That's cool.
Awesome. Alrighty, here we go. This is now it doesn't get any easier, just so you know.
Okay.
Number four, if you could only live in a country whose name starts with the letter K, which country would you live in?
Can you give me a list of all the countries in the world that start with K? I can only think of Kazakhstan off the top of my head, and right. I don't think
yeah, be Kazakhstan, but you can't go with Korea because Korea starts with south or north.
True.
So Kazakhstan, I think there's Kajikistan. I think that's it.
Kenya,
there we go.
Wait, Kyrgyzstan and Kurdistan.
There you go.
And Kiribati.
I'll go with Kazakhstan. That's at least I know where that is roughly.
You can hang out with what's his name from the movie.
It's walking distance to other cool places, so even if Kazakhstan isn't such a great place, I could go somewhere else.
Fair enough. All right, and number five, this is the toughest question you will ever answer, so get ready.
All right.
Would you rather be in a U.S. boy band or a J-pop adventure?
I'm going to go with boy band.
Okay, now the question is, this as a side question, which is your favorite boy band?
Ever in the history of the world?
Yes.
I'm going to go with... Man, that's hard.
The Monkees.
They're not a boy band. They don't count. They
totally are a boy band.
No, boy bands don't play instruments. They just sing and dance.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, right. That's the criteria.
Mm-hmm.
Now we know. Thank you.
So you could go with NSYNC, 98 Degrees, Boys to Men,
it's really sad
Backstreet Boys... you could even go with what was the band with Marky Mark in it?
New Kids on the Block.
New Kids on the Block, that counts.
And New Kids on the Block. His brother was in New Kids on the Block.
I know.
Sad that I know that. Just shush.
So
yeah, it was Donnie who was in New Kids on the Block.
And yeah, Marky I know. Mark. It was one of the calm down.
Get it right, man. I'll go with New Kids. Yeah.
New Kids? Okay.
I forgot those. Compelling conversation we have ever had on this podcast, so I gotta say.
I'm not really an expert on boy bands, so there could be better ones out there, and I just dropped the ball on that one, but they were around when I was kind of growing up. I'm showing my age here a little bit, but yeah, I'll go with the New Kids.
Mick Wahlberg was in the New Kids, so I think that says something about you.
Yeah, I'm older than Dirk.
commented because I'm the one that first brought it up. So,
oh my goodness. Okay.
Okay. So, so where can folks find you? Find your books? Are you? You said you're doing you're coming to the States for something. So, I mean, like, where's your website? All of that good stuff.
Yeah, I'll be over there next year. We don't have dates organized yet, so I'm not exactly sure. It'll probably be mid to late next year when book number two is coming out. But more details as they come to hand, I guess. My website is www.jchristoff.com. And it did get hacked yesterday. There was some malware on there, but I'm told it's all gone now, which is good. And yeah, you can get the book on Amazon. You can get it at Book Depository. You can get it anywhere good books are sold, I guess.
Who the hell would hack your website?
I don't know. It was a brute force attack from some website in China that put some malware behind the text of my main site that redirected to another site in, I don't know, it was somewhere like Uzbekistan or something. I don't know. It was weird.
Kazakhstan.
It wasn't Kazakhstan, no. But yeah, I just got a tweet from someone that said malware got installed through your site. Thanks very much, asshole. And got my web guy onto it. I know nothing about the function of the internet.
I think it's proof that you've made it. You haven't made it until there's malware installed on your website.
Yeah. It's gone now. It's gone. Thankfully, hopefully. I'm told anyway.
I'm just imagining, like, because of the, like, from a political perspective, since there's still conflict between Japan and China, that maybe they're mad that the book doesn't have enough Chinese influence, so they hacked your website to get back at you. But
well, apparently there was intent behind it. My web guy said it wasn't an accidental attack. It was someone was pissed off at me about something. So, yeah, maybe that's the case. Maybe.
Did you call a Chinese person a bad name?
No, not at all. Not as far as I'm aware.
He's highly critical of the Chinese government, and therefore...
Oh, that would be it. Yeah. All that stuff you're posting about how you don't like Chinese... Yeah, you got to be careful, man.
Yeah, everyone's watching now. But yeah, it's fixed. So if you go there now, you won't be infected. We have a clean bill of health.
Excellent.
Cool. So, all right. So everybody should go get the book. It's really good. We didn't get to talk about some of the stuff that I had originally pegged, but mostly because we ran longer talking about awesome stuff. So, but the writing is really good. So everybody should go buy the book and read it and like bask in the glory of his prose. Yeah. So, anyway, so go get the book. You can get it basically. If you're in the States, I mean, you know where to get books. So why do I have to tell you? You go to Amazon or like your bookstore or whatever. Wait. This is the 21st century. You people should know how to get books by now.
I don't think they do.
They don't? Okay. Well, he already said Amazon and Book Depository. And
so I don't know why you're repeating him.
Because I want them to know so they can buy the book.
As we suck bad at ending our show. So everybody go buy Stormancer. Thank you so much, Jay, for coming on the show and for being patient enough with us to reschedule twice.
That's all good. Thanks for getting me up at 8 a.m. on a Saturday.
Oh, you're most
three
welcome.
Times.
Have a nice, productive Saturday, or go back to bed. I recommend the latter.
Yeah, I might give that a shot, actually.
Cool. Well, thanks again, and it was great talking to you.
Excellent. Thanks very much for having me, guys. It was a lot of fun.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.